Well, it is 5:45, and I know that we're going to have to be up against some things in terms of
getting out of here.
Yeah, well, we have chapel, Vespers tonight at 7. So we're going to try and do this, and we're trying our best to make sure it works. I'm going to introduce myself for those of you who don't know me. I'm Pastor John Herbert. I am, as it says in my bio, I've been here before, and I spent a year and three months up here from 2015 through 2016, and which of course means that I was a part of the Wolverine Creek fire and its evacuation. Several of us that I see sitting here were there that day and the next day. You had a more exciting trip out the next day, the ones that went out August the 1st instead of July 31st. But I'm a pastor for 37 years in the ELCA, served congregations in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Idaho, Washington, and now Alaska. So what I'm going to do over the next few days is hopefully help you understand one of the most unique places I've ever been in my entire life. Can everybody hear me, by the way, too? I always want to make sure about that, otherwise I can't put it on. And one of the first things you need to understand when you go to Shishmaref, Alaska, is that you really do need to live, learn, and listen. Maybe not in that order, but that's how it came out. And it's a whole new orientation over anything else that I have ever lived at. And one of the reasons why I know it's a whole new orientation and knew that once I got there. This picture was taken from my parsonage window. It had great south-facing windows. The sun is setting in the south. The sun sets in the south during certain parts of the year, and the sun sets and the sun rises in the south certain parts of the year. I arrived in Shishmaref on January the 3rd. Because I've got this going on. Let's see. Okay, and now I got to figure out how to do this. But anyway, that's the kind of view I had. That's a gorgeous, it was incredible. And you're looking out, by the way, you're looking south. And so when you're looking south, this is a body of water. Well, which you can walk on and ride on and do all kinds of other things there too. But I was asked, okay, where is Shishmaref and how did I get here? Let me tell you a little bit about Shishmaref, I guess is a good way to put it. And I promise you this is one of the few that has my picture in it. By the way, in the background, that's the parsonage. Over there to my right, as you see the telephone poles, you might notice that it's also the cemetery. It's right next door. Shishmaref is 22 miles from the Arctic Circle, below the Arctic Circle. So when I did arrive there, there were 23 hours of darkness. At times the light was twilight, but in general, it was dark, a lot darker than it was light. Shishmaref has been inhabited for centuries. Not always in the way in which it is now inhabited. But you'll see this in a minute in the map that there, but the Inuit people, and they call themselves Inuit, and they also call them, like, one of the first things I had to find out is it okay to say Eskimo? They call themselves Eskimos all the time, so I got, you know, it was one of the things I really wanted to find out when I got there, what's appropriate in terms of how do they self-identify themselves. By the way, I've never been to Alaska before. Wow. I just felt called to do it. But how in the world do you get to Shishmaref? Where it's in Alaska. It's close to the, obviously close to the Arctic Circle. There it is. Shishmaref. By the way, Russia. From Wales, you really can't see Russia from Wales on a good day. It's 50 miles from here to there. It's about 100 miles from Shishmaref to Russia. So, and you see some of the, this is what's called the Seward Peninsula. Nome is the one city that you would call there that has most of the major services. It's also not necessarily a native village. It is a combination of Europeans and the natives. The Europeans, of course, arrived when the little thing called gold was discovered.
And they got a McDonald's?
Pardon?
They got a McDonald's.
Yeah. No, but they got a Subway. And they deliver to Shishmaref.
Really?
They deliver. Yes. Yeah, the pizza place does too. But throughout what's called the Seward Peninsula are small native Inuit or Inupik. No, the Inupik is their dialect of villages that exist there and are. And these are all little towns. Buckland used to have a Lutheran church, so did Darren. Shishmaref has a Lutheran church. It's the only church in town. So when people ask me that, when they ask me, well, how many people, they do this to pastors. How many people are members? And I said, well, there's 600 people in town. And you're the only church. Guess what? When somebody dies, they're coming to you, whether they came to church or not. So I considered every single person when I was in Shishmaref to be a member of the church. I never had any kind of distinction where I wanted to say that anybody I met with or didn't, I can almost guarantee you they were all baptized. It's one of the things they still, that I'm going to talk a little bit more tomorrow. But so, okay, but that tells you a little bit where it is, but let me give you a little bit more. There's what the island looks like. Shishmaref is located 22 miles from the Arctic Circle. It has been the home to the Inuit people for thousands of years. I actually have a little bit of a script, but it's a home like any other, unlike any other. Before the coming of the Europeans, this piece of property was inhabited. But not in the way in which it's inhabited now. It was inhabited for portions of the year. Just like the Native Americans here would come up here during hunting season, during the spring and the summer, and then go back down south, down to Idiot, down to Chelan, and that was the same sort of thing that happened for tens of thousands of years. There is archaeological evidence that says that there has been some kind of continuous habitation, or at least coming in and coming out over the last 1,500 to 2,000 years. But we know that area, because it's so close to the Bering, you're part of the Bering Land Bridge, or at least was the Bering Strait, the Bering Land Bridge, and so it is the place where Asians first came to America. And whatever they called it back then, their new land. And as you can tell, it's not very big. Shishmaref, Scarif Island is what they call it. It's about 5 miles long. And here, where the town is, it's about a half a mile wide. The church sits on the highest part of the of the community, at 13 feet above sea level. So it is not. And Shishmaref today, a population of around 600, is about 600 people. And 100 years ago, probably more like 100 people. Some things changed. Yes?
You said they came seasonally. What season and why did they?
The season they came, and I'll talk a lot about that. The season that they came was in the spring when the ice began to break up.
Okay.
Because that's hunting season. Yeah. Their main diet before the coming of Europeans was Ugruk seal, which is, well, it's about as long, about from here to maybe the end of the you know, they're big. They weigh 900 pounds. They would butcher it, put it on drying racks. They would take the blubber and they would rend it. And they would, and in the rending of it, they would create some of the most healthy seal oil that you'll ever eat. Tastes a little fishy, but, you know, okay, what a seal eat. The other thing they eat is walrus. They eat caribou. There's a story about, they ate reindeer. There's a story about how the reindeer got there, which is a great story, I think. And in the summer, berries. And blueberries, wild blueberries, and what's called salmon berries. Salmon berries are very tiny, little red. They look like salmon eggs, is what they look, you know, to me. And they are not like a blueberry that has a bush. They are ripe on the ground. So that's the kind of, that was their subsistence diet. Yeah. And for many of them, many of them prefer to eat that way to this day. It certainly is a healthier way for them to eat. There was hardly any diabetes in that population. Before the coming of us. Oh, how do you get there? So that was part of it. Well, I went from Seattle. That's about, well, Seattle's here. I'm a lot, you know, I was doing this on my iPad. I'm dumb. You know, I'm going to a brand new place for the very first time. And so what do? I get on a plane and say, I'm going to go all the way in one day. Nobody should go to Shishmaref in one day. You know, somebody should have told me, you can't do that. But you go to Anchorage, which is, I should get the little pointer. I should figure out how to use this thing, too. By the way, this is the first time I've ever taught at Holden, and I'm about ready to, as Barbara said earlier, about ready to pee my pants. So.
And I said, Holden is a forgiving place.
Yes.
You're doing great.
Yeah. Okay. I gotta figure out where. Who knows? Anyway, I go to Anchorage. Anchorage is up here somewhere. Where that the waterway goes in. Then you go to Nome. And then you sit in Nome for a few hours. Oh, by the way, when I went to Anchorage, you got a pretty good layover in Anchorage. And so I got to wander around the Anchorage Airport. How many of you have been to Anchorage Airport? Wow. Have you gone through where, have you looked where they've had the artwork? Yeah, there's an art museum there. And I'm, you know, I've got 4 hours to sit there and wait. And so I'm wandering through there, and I wander up to where there is a museum. And it is my first encounter with the artwork of Shishmaref. I've just got a couple of items. I'm going to have a lot more over the next couple of days I'm going to put out. But these people are incredible, incredible artists. And they're bone carvers. And I have several, well, I'll put, you know, and it's okay to look at it. This is the vertebrae of a whale. And he turned it into a dancing figure that's drumming. And, this is ivory, walrus. Another one on the other side with a different face, and it's mastodon ivory. That's a little bit, that's the one thing to be a little bit careful. That's the drum. It used to have a little stick that came out of there, but it broke off. And I haven't been able to get that fixed. But anyway, you get the Nome, and you got another layover. Luckily, I met some people who were teachers. I'm coming in on January the 3rd, and the teachers are returning. And they see me. I'm the only white guy along with a few of them, and they introduce themselves to me right away. And they are teachers, and then they take me on a tour of Nome. Nome's a nice little town. Some great museums, great people. It also is where the Iditarod is. I got to go to the Iditarod. It's a new mindset. It really is, because, you know, I look at it and go, those dogs, like, you know, some of them die during it. But I also saw how much love that the owners of the dogs actually have for them, too. So it's a mixed thing. Anyway, so we hang out in Sir Smurf. It's dark. And then I get on another plane. By the way, to Nome is on a nice Alaska Airlines plane. And then I get on another plane, and it's a 9-seater. And because there is only one way to get into Shishmaref, and that's by plane. During the winter, you can do it by what they call snow machines. They don't call them snowmobiles out there. They call them snow machines. So they do. And so I arrived, and it's, so here's my, by the way, this is the church. So how did the 60-foot, you know, I didn't take this picture. I wish I had. And we saw some great, those of us who came up today saw some incredible rainbows on Lake Chelan today. But I took that off their Facebook page. So I stole a few of those pictures. By the way, the picture of me was taken by a woman by the name of Kathy Blumker. Mm-hmm. Kathy, if you know, is married to Dick. And they're on our boat. They're on the board here. Mm-hmm. Kathy and Dick came to see me in April, which, when you know anything about how hard it is to get there, that was a gift. But why me? What caused me to be the person to go up there? They needed an interim. In October of last year, I get a phone call. I get a phone call from, it's all her fault. This is Shelley Wickstrom. She is one of the most talented and authentic bishops I've ever met in my life. And I've had several bishops over my lifetime. And some, particularly someone who used to be the executive director here, Martin Wells, was my bishop for 18 years. And I'll be honest, when I was in trouble, he saved my tuchus. My career was going, my life was going in a bad direction, and he allowed that to happen, that me to continue and to be supportive of me. But Shelley is the one that called me. Shelley I've known for about 20 years. My sister has known her for 40. She trained my sister how to be a counselor at Camp Luther Haven on Lake Coeur d'Alene. And she's from Spokane. She knew me. And she felt like, since I came from a small town, population 365, when I graduated from high school, 17 of us, 12 of us went to school together for 12 years, so I understood little towns. And she said, you've been doing this a long time, and you understand people who are in deep grief, because they're in deep grief, for a lot of reasons. Let's see, does this work? Or do I just gotta go over here? I'd like to share, by the way, when I was there, I kept a journal. I wrote something every day, pretty much for the full 6 months I was there. Towards the end, it got a little harder to do. Part of that was because I was trying to spend more time with people and not just, you know, writing about what I experienced. But over the next 3 days, what I would like to do is also share some of those readings with you. This is what I wrote when I was on the plane between Nome and Anchorage and Nome. So I didn't know I knew I was going to get in a small plane. And I've flown small planes before, so. But, you know, you don't know. And so here's what I wrote. And here's what I was feeling. What does one expect when they go to a cold and remote place? What shall I find as I travel this in this airplane to Nome and then Shishmaref to a welcome from the people there? I'm of mixed feelings this day. Perhaps this will be the greatest adventure of my life. That is my hope. Then what if it isn't? See, typical, you know, I'm a German. What can go wrong will go wrong. That's the mixed mind that I'm speaking about. Each day I shall try and reflect on what I have witnessed and try to record them in this place. I'm lousy at that sort of thing, so it's a miracle even that I actually did it. But I believe I'm going to need this outlet to express my feelings, my hopes, and reality. Will they meet in equilibrium, or will they be disjointed and unmatchable? It is an opportunity to reflect on my life, my future, and the care I will receive from these people.
Can I listen as I should, or will I fall back and forget that I am here to listen and learn from a people who have so much to teach me and so much to teach others? It was an honor. It was maybe the best thing I've ever done in my life. And so I owe her. She also still has my sourdough starter. They make the best sourdough pancakes you'll ever have in your life, and I know the man who I can tell you who to go see. It's her fault. She called me. I think you can do this. I took a few days to think about it, wrap my head around it, and then began to talk to my family. My ex-wife told me, you'll never do this. You should never do this. That might have been one of the reasons why I did it. I know who I am. But Shelley, they love her, by the way. The people of Shishmaref loved her. This is what they did. When she called me in October, she really wanted me there by the 1st of December. And I said, I want to see my kids before I go to before Christmas. I didn't want to do this. I also knew I wanted to come up here again because I always come up for Thanksgiving and then stay for that funky Swedish festival that Peg and Chuck do. I can't remember. So what's it called? That's what it's called. Where's Chuck? But anyway, I always stay for that, and I wanted to be able to do that one more time before I came up here. Part of this is because Holden has been the place where I'm most grounded and felt like this would be good, to come up there. I probably should have gone up a little bit earlier, but what Shelley did, here she is, the bishop. She flies to Shishmaref at the first part of January, and she stays all through Advent, through Christmas, to make sure these people have a pastor. They love them, and she loves them. She began her ministry in a place called Derry, and here's what she told me shortly before I left. She said, if you go to a village and you become a part of the village, it will be with you forever. And she's right. She's right. I mean, I'm only gone for a few months, but how's this doing? Are we?
I can get a clicker.
Okay. Technology. See, we never have this problem but up in Chish. But there is technology up there, I should tell you that. Of this town of 600, they do all have electricity. The electricity is it's the same substance that's being used at the water at the water treatment plant. They're using diesel. Mm-hmm. Where do they get the diesel? The diesel comes from, comes from Alaska. The only deal is they have to start up on, I cannot pronounce the name. Baro is, they've gone back to the native name. And I tried really hard to learn how to pronounce the names. It's really hard. So sometimes I shift back to what I used to be. But Baro, that's where they get the oil. They take it all the way down to Valdez by pipeline. They put it on a boat. Bring it to Washington State, refine it, take it by barge, back up to Alaska, and by barge up to Shishmaref. A gallon of gas was about $7 a gallon in Alaska, which is overflowing with oil.
But with a 5-mile island, you don't drive very far.
No, and of course, there's no cars. There's a few cars on the island. There's a few cars on the island. Most of them are snow machines and four-wheelers, ATVs. It's not going well, is it?
No.
Okay. I'll just keep talking. By the way, here, and if you live in Alaska or you live up there, in the North Country, there are two sides. This is made out of a moose antler. This is the happy side. The black that you see on there above that makes the eyebrows, that's Boeing.
Oh.
Yeah. And this is more a little bit of the dark. that also exists there. It looks like we're getting close. Maybe. Right there. Start from there. Okay.
Yeah, let's try that.
Okay. How about, go to slideshow. There you go. From there. Why is that doing that?
I have not seen that before.
This is because it's me. Yeah. Go to slide.
So I just have a
question.
You just some of the things that you were talking about. You said Lutheran, only church, everybody.
How did that happen?
Well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Start there.
I'll start there. In the 1890s, there was a, as the Americas become, as we become the owners of Alaska, that happens, of course, in 1860-something at Seward's Folly. It's after Lincoln. It's actually during the first president that has been impeached, Johnson. Probably not going to be the last, but we'll see. Yeah, well, we know he wasn't the last. But in the 1890s, then, so America was moving up there. The United States was moving up there. They are dividing. They used the same kind of model that they used in the for the reservation system. And in this case, they reached out to churches, and they divided the church up. Or the territories up. The Seward Peninsula became Lutherans. Now, why Lutherans there? Part of that is because the individual who was in charge of Alaska at this time, a man by the name of Sheldon Jackson. Sheldon Jackson had come up, and he's kind of a showman, and he's trying to teach everybody, you should come to Alaska, and since he's Presbyterian, he wants to get missionaries up there. And so what does he do? He goes to Minnesota. And in the missionary societies, the ladies' aid societies that existed back at those times, he says, look, there's all these heathen people that are damned and going to hell. And what are you going to do? And so that begins the process. But also what happened, and this has to do with the reindeer being there. Reindeer and caribou, as you probably know, are basically the same animal. Reindeer are domesticated. And they were domesticated in places like Russia and Norway. So Sheldon Jackson gets there, and he looks around and he sees all these drying racks. And when he's looking at the drying racks, they're empty. He says, these people are starving. We got to get food to them. Reindeer. He gets the idea of bringing reindeer over. Well, you need to teach the native population, the indigenous population, how to become reindeer herders. They got the reindeer from the Russians. The Alaskan people, the native people, hate the Russians. They weren't any nicer than we are. They said no. And so they said Norwegians. Norwegians said, we'll come, but we want a pastor. And that's how that area becomes, those good, pious Norwegians are the reason why it's there.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a little bit, it's more complicated than that. This is one of the best reads about Shishmaref that I think you'll ever find out. I knew a little bit about Shishmaref before I went. I knew it was an area where climate change was and climate disruption was happening. But this was written back 2015. Fierce Climate, Sacred Ground. It's an ethnography of climate change in Shishmaref, Alaska. What's fascinating about the book is, of course, since I know all these people, because she went up and she lived with them, and she spent over a period of time, up 6 months up there, so about the same period of time. I've emailed her a few times in the hope that she might email me back, but that hasn't happened yet. So Fierce Climate, Sacred Ground is really where it's at. Okay. If you want to know what Shishmaref is about, this is the first and the last image in my mind when it comes, when I think of Shishmaref. Here's what I wrote. I saw them pick up the tools this morning. Tools for the digging. Shovels, picks, and the like. They marked off the grave and waited for others to come. It was about minus 28, with a wind chill making it feel like minus 40s. They were preparing to dig the grave for John. When I arrived at Shishmaref, I knew I was going to have a funeral. He died the day after Christmas. Johnny, 83 years old, and an elder in the village. When I walked out there were about five men. They first cleared the snow away and then marked out the grave with a pickaxe. It would be 8 feet by 4 feet. Archie had brought a jackhammer and connected to the generator, began to loosen the sod, marking it with a grid that would make the sod movable. Then as more men arrived, the digging began. All of us took turns, though my helping was minimal. This was holy work on holy ground. There are no granite or marble headstones. By the way, I found out later there are a couple of several from veterans that served in Vietnam. I'm amazed at how many of the indigenous people served in our military from World War II on. I'm amazed how many of them were veterans. What there are is simple wooden crosses and the names and dates of the person in the beginning and end of their lives. On many is a Bible verse reference. They are painted white and they watch over the remains of those villagers who have gone before them. This is a community ritual, a ritual that is done with respect, but also a sense of fellowship. They welcome me to this holy time. This is deep stuff that will stay with me a long time, too. I'll be doing the funeral for Johnny soon. When I do, it will be different than any other. There is no paid employees to use the backhoe. There is the work of human beings, lifting sod, picking axe to loosen the sand, and shovels to lift out the sand so that Johnny will rest in peace. Deep peace, indeed. Yeah, it was cold. The funeral was 4 hours long. My part was 20 minutes. You get up, you say your say, you preach the gospel, you sit down, and you get out of the way. What's going to happen is going to be amazing. It is the community grieving together. And they wait for everybody to be able to come. In the wintertime, that's a little easy. Johnny ended up being embalmed. There was they weren't sure why he had died suddenly. And so they did an autopsy. They shipped him to Seattle. That's very, very unusual. Most of the bodies that are buried there are not embalmed. It's cold enough most of the time where that can be done. In the summertime, I didn't do a funeral. Well, I did one in June, and what they did, there's still ice. There's still snow around. They just put it in the morgue. By the way, the morgue is right next door to the parsonage. And they put ice in there, and they put a fan in there and blow the ice around to keep the bodies from decaying. This stays with me every day. This is why I think I'll go back someday. I'm 37 years of being a pastor, and I've never watched somebody dig a grave. Yeah. And they do it for every one of them. That's faithful. When you get there, you find out, oh good, there's a couple of stores. Welcome to Shishmaref. That's the airport. Well, I call it an airfield. There is no building. There's a building there, as you can tell. But by the way, that's the last picture I took when I left almost the last picture I took when I left from Shishmaref. Because when I got there, it was so dark and so cold. I mean, Rich Tosenko, who is a European, he comes from Cleveland. He moved there in the 70s. Met a woman the first day he was there, married to her 4 months later. She is the president of the congregation. She's on the council there. You know, I mean, you got to live there. In any small town, if you've grown up in a small town, you got to live there a long time before you're part of the family. Rich is, by now, he's part of the family. You know. The Shishmaref Native Store, it's a basic grocery store. And I mean basic. Not a lot there. Canned goods, processed food, frozen goods, and occasionally bread, occasionally milk, and occasionally eggs. But that doesn't always happen. That's about what a house looks like in Shish.
There's the four, snow machine. Most of the houses that, most of them are heated by oil, stove oil.
There is no plumbing in Shishmaref. You either have your own septic system, as in a septic tank, or you have a honey bucket, and you take it out to a container, and then the city picks it up later on. There is no running water in Shishmaref. You have to get your own water. They have been so screwed by the United States. They have nothing up there. They give them tastes of what life is, of what life here is. Yes, there is internet now. You can do that. It costs you an arm and a leg. Yeah, you get some of the technology. You got cable if you want. And people got big TVs too, but not really. They're poor, and they make them do. It's hard work. It's a beautiful moon up there too. I never saw the Northern Lights. I went the wrong season. You got to be there in the fall. Yeah. Shishmaref, it just gets so cold that, and it's cloud. It's all right on the ocean. Yeah, it's on what's called the Chukchi Sea, so you don't see a lot of that. That's the post office right there. This is the third most important building in the town. It's the community center, and it's the place where bingo happens. And bingo is popular, very popular. The post office and the city building is there. The first most important one is the church. The second is the school. It's actually probably the school first, and then the church.
Is that a concrete street or
asphalt? No, there are two asphalt streets in Shishmaref. And that's new. That's new. Before, it's always been just like this. And you see here, that's asphalt. So that's recent, fairly recent, since they put in there. But most of the roads are like what roads there are. There are no roads. There's trails that you follow. Then you follow them on your four-wheeler or your snow machine. My snow machine didn't work when I first got there. I begged them to make sure they got it fixed, and my friend Kuzi did. And it's a lot of fun, I'll admit it. Snow machine, it's fun. Even going out when it's 20 degrees below zero and the sun's shining, it's not bad. But there is this. The storms. I went 3 weeks without bread, milk, or eggs. Milk, by the way, comes in cartons that are not, don't need to be refrigerated until you open. Mm-hmm. So they come in quart. A gallon of milk, somewhere between $12 and $13. So that's a storm out my back. Same window that I took the picture out of the, and that is what it's like sometimes. The wind blows, sometimes up to 35 miles an hour. There's a part, and I'll show you later. I'm sure if I have a picture of the, but in between the parsonage and the church is enough room for a couple of snow machines to go through, and they go by frequently. But that creates kind of a wind tunnel. And there were times when I just wanted to go off and get into my bed and pull the covers because I didn't want to hear the wind blowing anymore. So. It's a little crazy to live there, and I'm worried about that. But the church always has an agreement with the pastor that comes up. If this doesn't work after 30 days, and everybody says, and always the pastor can say, I have to leave. And there's a 30-day no harm, no foul. So if I got up there in the first 30, I could have walked out, and they would have paid for my trip out. That's not cheap. cost me about, it didn't cost me, but it cost them about $2,000 just to get me up there. This is the seawall up there. And I don't know if this is going to work or not, because but I thought it might be not a bad thing to hear that wind. So let's see if this works. And I don't think it's going to work. The sound isn't there. We're going to have to fix that for tomorrow for sure, because tomorrow I have them singing. But
so how high is that seawall?
That seawall is about 8 feet. And let me show you what, and by the way, this is way too soon for this, for us to see water. In fact, this is the next picture I'll show you. That's what the Chukchi Sea looks like on January the 5th. That has 4 to 5 foot ice on it. And it goes out as far as you can see. And traditionally, it's there from mid-November through breakup is in May. This is what happened on January 29th. Here's what I wrote. It began with the shift of the wind. No longer would it come out of the north, but it came through the south from the southeast. The wind blows constantly here due to the close proximity to of the sea. This time, though, it came from over the land, and the temperatures it brought were warm and the wind strong, 25 to 30 miles per hour. The wind would sweep over the sea ice near the shore, and before long it began to melt, and you could hear the ice cracking as the tide began to shift. The sea, fed now by the winds, pushed and heaved the cracking ice that you could hear from the shore. The waves and the ice were no longer stable, but crashing upon the seawall that was there to protect that end of the village. Now the ice isn't solid, but huge chunks of ice freely floating in the melting waters around it. The sea continued to rise and toss the ice chunks into the wall, but soon it wasn't just being dashed against the seawall, but over it. Crashing ice chunks, blocks of ice up and over the wall, and now between the village and on the wrong side of some of the seawall. Over the course of the day and well into the night, the blocks of ice weighing tons were lifted up on the stormy sea, and they weighed like they weighed nothing at all. Chunks and chunks lifted and deposited on more ice chunks that had gone over, and with the last powerful wave to come crashing into the barrier placed there by humans and now being ignored by the sea and the wind. The next day I walked down to get my groceries and saw for the first time the results of the storm. One of the elders was standing there too. She looked at me and sighed and said, "Never in all my time living here have I seen this happen." Yeah. The ice never reformed. We were very, very lucky in hunting season this year. They thought they were going to have little or no hunting. They got lucky. They got fortunate. And when they went out onto the ice, because the ice now is so much further out, used to be they could go out with snow machines and drag them back, put them in, you know, get them off the ice, and now they have to go out with boats and into the sea, and they have to be really, really careful about when. This was like nothing I'd ever seen, ever before.
Excuse me, please.
And there's my home.
Question?
Question?
Yep. Yes.
Oh, this slide, I think, answers my question. I was wondering how high those blocks of ice were. I saw a post in the foreground that I was wondering how big the post was and so forth.
Come tomorrow when I've got a better slide that will show you Kathy Blumker sitting and standing right next to them. And independent, but there are places where the government put in a seawall back in the 80s. This, because Shishmaref started losing, Shishmaref has been the
the canary in the coal mine of climate change since the 1970s. Because of the erosion, you might even remember seeing pictures of these houses just falling into the sea. The government came in, Corps of Engineers put in a seawall for part of the island, not the whole island. And what that has done has caused, it's actually made it worse. In the case of the, where if we went backwards and saw that again, they were about, it was on the lowest part of the seawall where they were, but they were about 10 feet tall. That's how much ice you could stand. You had to climb up on it, and they had to tell the kids, please stay off the icebergs, because there's kids everywhere. Six of the 600 people that live there, about 250 of them are under 18. They love children. And by the way, if you have a baby and you're 16 and you don't happen to be married, there's no shame, because the village is going to break that, make sure that baby gets raised. It's a communal place. By the way, that building burned out, not particular building, but that building was built by a bunch of Lutherans with local help in the 80s, because the original church was built in the 1950s, and it burned to the ground.
John, are you going to talk about healthcare? You talked a little bit about pregnancy.
Yeah, I will. I can do a little bit of that right now. That's a good. Healthcare, there is a clinic there. There's two PAs that are there. I only met one of them because a good young woman was having a seizure in the middle of a worship service, and we, you know, you go visit the person, the woman. But healthcare is better than it used to be. Because their PA's there, there's a clinic there. They really would like to build a new one. It's not big enough. There's no X-ray machine. So if you need any kind of help at all, and you're not feeling very well, you got to get out. You got to fly to Nome. The Native Corporation. They don't call themselves tribes. They call them. They organize themselves as the Shishmaref Native Corporation, but it's just another word for their government authority on the and they provide health care. That's part of what they provide. There is also social services that are provided through what's called the IRA, so there's a couple of counselors that are there as well. And in the basement also is the EPA, the local EPA. And so they've got a couple of employees. If you want employment there, you work for the clinic, you work for the city, you work for the church, and that's just me, or you work for one of the corporation or the school are the major employees. A lot of women, more women than, no, I take that back. When I first got there, I noticed more women Native teachers that had come back, who had graduated from Shish and then came back. So the healthcare is minimal. I buried a woman, I think, that she died because they didn't get her out soon enough. By the time I got her, it was too late. There was two women there that had the same form of cancer. The one got out right away, and the other one did, a month later. Can't get out, and it might be, so. It's tenuous at best. There's no place for you to live if you needed some kind of assisted living. People take care of it, or they go to Nome. And a lot of people have moved because they have to. They're just not possible. By the way, this was my greeting. I walked in. I told you about how Rich picked me up and dropped me off at the parsonage. He didn't really spend very much time with me. I kind of figured he wanted, you know, you're probably overwhelmed. But anyway, showed me where everything was, and he said, "Archie will call you tomorrow and show you how to use everything." I go and I walk into the kitchen and look up on the wall, and that's waiting for me.
Pardon?
Annie and Thomas?
I think it's been there longer.
Longer?
Yeah. My predecessor, by the way, I should tell you a little, just a little bit about Annie and Thomas and Tommy Richter were the my predecessors. Tommy was the pastor. And they're Holden people. They've come here quite a few times over the years. In fact, Annie might have.
She went to school.
She went to school here.
Yeah, she did.
It is a hard, hard place to be if you're not connected. And they went up there believing they'd be able to stay for 3-4 years. They got to year two and it got bad. And Annie, I think, I don't want to blame Annie, but I think it was harder for Annie than it was for Tom. But part of that is there's no jobs. You know, so you sit there, and the parsonage is where, and this is one of the things I had to tell them, is quit having council meetings in the parsonage. Have them in the church. Well, it's nicer in the parsonage. Yeah, but somebody lives there. And there, a lot of that they don't understand. They don't understand because of that cultural thing. And I said, I think, you know, one of the things that Shelley wanted me to do is to look for the reasons why people are leaving. The last 2 to 3 pastors have left after only 2 to 3 years. We believe that actually should be a term call. 3 years with a possibility of a fourth. Unfortunately, that's still hard to find somebody to go. They're still looking. I had to leave after 6 months because I had another commitment. I wish I hadn't had that. But talk about making you feel home. And by the way, for those of you who don't know this, I love to make bread. And I love to make communion bread for Holden Village. And when I left Holden at the end of 2016, September of 2016, and became an interim pastor down in Boise, that's one of the things I did for them, was make bread. Didn't do it every Sunday, because they had other people for us too. But wow, did that make me feel good on, you know, it's 40 degrees below zero. And it is just incredible. But these are the people. Just a few. And I'll talk more about them tomorrow, too. Now, there's another piece of life up in Shishmaref. They all smoke. They all smoke heavy. It's like walking into a 50s movie, you know, with Humphrey Bogart, you know, everybody in the room is smoking. Now, they don't smoke it. Now, I will tell you, they have stopped smoking inside because the housing, as you saw, if something catches on fire, it burns. So they're a lot better. And they almost all of them have little porches that have been built, you know, where you got to walk through it. And they probably got one, they use that as a place to keep the meat cold because you don't need a freezer. but they stand, then they stay, they're a little bit out of the wind. And so they'll stand there and smoke.
How about alcohol? Is it dry?
It's a dry village, but as you know, Prohibition didn't work in the United States, and it doesn't work there. Here's what I experienced. Alcoholism is very high. The rate of alcoholism is very high. Yes, it's a dry village, but people know that you can always find it. Hopefully, not through buying yeast and then buying... by the way, they put the yeast behind the counter. So you won't take it, and you know, because you make, you know, and then buy apple juice and put some more something else in it. Next thing you know, you got a little, you know, you got Applejack. Doesn't taste very good, and it does funny things to your brain. Most of the time that I saw the people who I knew were drinking, and you figure that out in a small town, who's struggling and who isn't. Rarely did I see anybody drunk in public, but when you would go out, you know, after a day or so, when you'd go out on your snowmobile and you'd look out on the pathway and you'd see a pint thing of R&R, Canadian whiskey, and what I believe happened, the stories is, what happens is they put their snow machine up, put their sled on the back of their snow machine, and then they drive the 140 miles to Nome, which is a wet city. And then they buy cases and cases of pint jars of alcohol. And then they go back and they sell them for $100 a piece.
Cool.
Marijuana is legal in Alaska. It's also not prohibited. It is prohibited in the village. But once again, you know, it doesn't always happen. I mean, I knew, I was there 2 months and figured out who was selling pot. And yeah, it didn't take long to, even the, if the pastor can figure it out in a short period of time, you knew. Yes, sir, and unfortunately, some of there's some meth up there, too. It's a hard life. I used to, you know, I'd tell them every once in a while, you know, I'd say, man, I wish you wouldn't smoke cigarettes. But then I stopped and said, you know, what right do I have to say that? I don't know what they're like. You know, they know as much as we know. These are sophisticated people. By the way, they've been interviewed by all kinds of people. I had people knock on my door and they're from National Geographic. Mm-hmm. They're up there. they are, there used to be an interview. The couple from National Geographic, they filmed me visiting with a Clara and Shelton, and they, as we just talked about the way things used to be and how the ice was there, and then they even filmed me giving them communion. Eventually, we'll all end up on TV, you know. And we gave them, they're used to it, and as long as you teach, treat, and I try and be very careful about, you know, even saying people's names sometimes, too. Because they're private, and they've been taken advantage of. The parsonage, as you saw, is big. We had a guy from Norway was there for 3 weeks, stayed with me, and he pays a little bit of rent. And he went around interviewing people, taking pictures, and he'll do something on climate change in Norway. And they have been interviewed there. CNN has been there. By the way, Claire and Shelton had their son die on the ice. He was on a snow machine, and it cracked, and he died. Yeah. Everybody has stories like that. Every single person has stories like that. That's the cross in front of the church. It's made out of ivory. Made out of, you know, ivory from, by the way, I wrote this a note that I wrote myself. If I could have taken it home with me, I would have. It's absolutely, I mean, it's a, you know, pretty decent sized cross, and but that's ivory and baleen from Wales. Yeah. The church really is the center of the town of Wadley's, even though sometimes it's not very full, but they believe in the power of prayer. Some ways, it's, you know, I look at it and I go, that's not the way I see it. But they believe in the power of prayer, that it helps them get through every day. And they testify to that. I mean, they're comfortable talking about their faith. Not all of them, because as I say, not everybody. When I first arrived, probably 12 people were showing up to church. By the time, yeah, but it's cold. And they have just finished, see, this is why I should have went up for Advent, Christmas. They have a huge celebration. It's the end of, okay, it's the beginning of the light. The light's coming. And they know it's coming. And they understand Advent. And they have dog sled races. They have, you know, basketball games. They have all kinds of things that are, that bring the community together. And then after Christmas, and they have, you know, the church hosts a major feast for the whole town, and then after Christmas, they all go into their rooms and their little houses, and they hibernate for a while. You know, and so when I first got there, not a lot of people, but by the time I left, it was 50 to 60 on a Sunday, and I had one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had in my life when I left. They love to sing. They do a thing called Singspiration. And it's not Lutheran music. It has its origins, I think. It feels like Appalachian. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of revivalistic gospel, old time gospel music. It's all four part harmony, and they love to sing in four part harmony. Somebody has taught, you know, and the church, I think, has done a lot of teaching of music, and the school as well, and. They love, and when I left, they had a special sing-spiration. Started at 7:30 and it ended at 11:30 at night. And when I told that to Bishop Shelley, Shelley said, that just means you're part of the family. I've never, ever found people like this. And I know we have, and I'm past my time and I need to shut up. Because we have we were supposed to be next door, but somehow that didn't get set up, so we're here. And I know we have Vespers. I do this tomorrow as well, but more time, and lots more time for questions.